I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Police in Spain have identified 5 new suspects in last week's train bombings in Madrid, all Moroccan-born. Authorities also detained an Algerian who allegedly talked about a terrorist attack in Madrid 2 months before it happened. Meantime, a Moroccan official is saying there's a possible link between the prime suspect, Jamal Zougam, and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, believed to be a key al-Qaeda operative. We'll have more about the alleged connections to the Madrid bombings in a moment. But first, we turn to Pakistan, where the Pakistani army is intensifying its push into a border region with Afghanistan in an attempt to find fugitive Taliban and al-Qaeda operatives. Pakistani troops today killed more than 20 suspects in a violent crackdown in a small village along the border, this on the eve of Secretary of State Colin Powell's 2-day visit to Pakistan. Anwar Iqbal is a Southeast Asia analyst for United Press International. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. Mr. Iqbal, I know you were just in this region. It sounds like a very large operation in a rather desolate village. Tell us about it.
Yes. Hi. I was there last month, and I think that they have deployed about 75,000 troops in these tribal areas. And it's a long area, I mean, more than 1,000 miles, and goes from southwestern Pakistan to northwestern Afghanistan. And in some of these areas, this is the first time that Pakistani troops have entered because of an agreement between the tribes and the British when they were still ruling India. These areas were declared free tribal territory, and the federal government was not allowed to send troops there. They have, and I think from what I saw there, I think this time the government is serious in working with the United States to catch the Taliban and al-Qaeda fugitives.
Well, Mr. Iqbal, tell us more about that. This area is fairly autonomous. Why is this crackdown happening now?
My feeling is, that after the assassination attempt on Mr. Musharraf, and I mean, of course, the feeling is based on the interview that I conducted in Islamabad and in the tribal areas. After this assassination attempt, the government is convinced that the Taliban and al-Qaeda fugitives hiding in those areas and hiding in some settled areas of Pakistan as well are as much a threat to Musharraf and his government and to the Pakistani interests as they are to the U.S. and Western interests.
Yeah. President Musharraf, in fact, acknowledged yesterday for the first time that the tribesmen that you mentioned in this region could be harboring 500 to 600 foreigners. He said, "We will not allow foreigners to get training in our tribal areas, store explosives, and then go back to Afghanistan for killing their Muslim brothers." And as you point out, pointing their guns perhaps at him, the president. How much luck do you think he's going to have with, in effect, telling these tribesmen the jig is up?
I think what he did in Peshawar was he did two things. He made it very obvious. Number one, I listened to his speech on one of the Pakistani channels. He made it very obvious that the government is serious, that they are going to go after anyone who hides these fugitives, and that they have, in fact, demolished some of the houses where they had learned that suspects had been hiding before the troops came. They also have arrested some people. They also have formed a lashkar or an army of tribal fighters and send them to the areas where they think people might have hidden or hiding these fugitives, and warning them that, look, if you do not hand them over, the Pakistani troops will come and demolish your houses, and they will go and come and arrest you. So, yes, this is one thing. I mean, he's telling them that, look, we are really serious, we are tough, and we are going to come after you.
Mr. Iqbal, we only have a few seconds left. I just want to ask, and please complete your thought, but also add to it, is there any sense that Osama bin Laden might be in this region?
I mean, he is. My feeling is he's moving in and out. Yes, he is there, but he's moving in and out. He goes to Afghanistan, comes to Pakistan. He's not staying at any one place, and he travels in small groups. And also, Musharraf made another offer. He said that those who surrender will not be handed over to a third country. I don't know whether the Americans support this offer or not, but that is a big offer, which may induce some people to surrender.
And just a couple seconds left. All of this happened with Colin Powell's visit on the horizon. That may be a topic that they discuss.
I think that is going to be one of the main topics that they will discuss.
Yeah. What happens to these fugitives? Well, Mr. Iqbal, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Anwar Iqbal, Southeast Analyst for United Press International. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
As we mentioned at the top of the program, in Spain, the search continues for who's behind last week's terrorist attack. The death toll's now risen above 200. We're joined by Christopher Dickey, who's Middle East regional correspondent for Newsweek. He joins us from Paris. Welcome, Chris.
It's my pleasure.
Chris, how much doubt is there at this point among intelligence experts that there's an al-Qaeda link to the attack in Spain?
Well, there's less and less doubt all the time, but there are still some things that they find puzzling. Normally, in this kind of attack, if it were al-Qaeda-related, you would have seen some suicide bombers involved. It doesn't appear that that was the case in this instance. Also, the question of the kinds of explosives that were used raised a lot of issues. But it certainly looks like they have caught one man who was involved with the cell phones that were used as detonators or as triggers. And he has a lot of suspicious connections that the police have known about for some time, and those all point in the direction of al-Qaeda.
Has a link to the Basque separatist group ETA been ruled out?
Well, not entirely. Not entirely, but ETA's representatives, or people claiming to be those representatives, who had voices and IDs known to the press in Spain, especially in the Basque country, have denied any involvement. The timing of it looked like ETA. The target looked like ETA, but the size of the attack was much, much bigger than anything that ETA had ever done before. More people were killed in this, not only than any other single incident, but they would have represented about a quarter of all the people killed by ETA in 36 years of activity.
Chris, what about what's being called cross-pollination, a link between al-Qaeda and ETA?
Well, that's what has people really scared. If al-Qaeda or its operatives and people linked to its ideals have been able to establish working relationships with ETA or with some of the French groups of the IRA or with other secular organizations, maybe as far afield as Colombia or the jungles of South America, then all of a sudden you've got a different ball game logistically, technically, with trying to stop terrorist movements. They can go places they couldn't go before, use agents they couldn't use before, and acquire the kinds of weapons and explosives they might not have had ready access to before. And there are a lot of things about the Madrid attack that suggest that might be the case. The specific explosives, the detonators, a number of issues like that have led people in the security services to keep their eye focused on that possibility.
Chris, you alluded to prime suspect Moroccan immigrant Jamal Zougam. What's the strongest link investigators cite for his connection to al-Qaeda in the minute or so we have left?
Well, he's linked to the telephone that was found in one of the unexploded bombs. There was one in a gym bag that was recovered, and it had a telephone with an alarm that was set to go off and detonate the bomb. The alarm went off actually 12 hours exactly after it should have, so somebody had misset it. Anyway, that phone card that made that phone work was acquired from a store where Jamal Zougam worked. And because of his past record, because he'd been under surveillance by the French as well as the Spanish and the Moroccan police at various times, he instantly became a prime suspect.
And a follower of Imad Yarkas, the jailed alleged head of al-Qaeda in Spain, right, Chris?
Yeah, he was linked to Yarkas. What exactly those links are is not clear. When everybody else in the Yarkas network was arrested, Zougam was allowed to remain at large. I'm sure they regret that now, but they didn't have enough on him to nail him.
Christopher Dickey of Newsweek joined us from Paris. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
The government of Greece has redoubled security efforts following the Madrid bombing. With just 5 months to go until the Summer Olympics, security costs are ballooning to over $1 billion. The fear is that a huge gathering of athletes and tourists at the birthplace of Western civilization may be the perfect target for a terrorist attack. Well, joining us from Athens is Bob McDonald. He reports for the Economist Intelligence Unit. Bob, Greece has asked NATO for security. It will probably come. But what do Greek officials hope to get?
They've asked for the use of early warning aircraft, AWACS, to do over-the-horizon surveillance. They've asked for naval patrols to help beef up their own domestic patrols on ports And apparently they've asked for a Czech brigade, which is trained in dealing with biological and chemical warfare.
How much will that add to the already ballooning costs of this Olympics? Who's going to pay for this?
Well, this is just the major question. Greece says it can't pay for this. And they are hoping that they will be able to invoke the alliance provision whereby a nation in need from a perceived threat can call upon the assistance of NATO partners. This is certainly not a use of this a clause that has ever been made before. Usually it's only invoked in time of hostilities. But it does maybe have some legitimacy in current circumstances, and it may well be that the tab would get picked up by the NATO partners.
Right now we understand that there's an Olympic security drill going on. It's called Shield of Hercules 2004. It began last Wednesday. Can you tell us anything about it?
It's being kept pretty tightly under wraps. The reports that we have seen say that there are about 1,500 Greek military, police, and Coast Guard, and maybe about 400 U.S. soldiers. And they're concentrating on Attica, where most of the Games events will be, but they're also looking at venues such as Volos and Paphos and Heraklion on the island of Crete, where there will be soccer preliminaries.
Tell us a little bit about Athens and how the games are going to be set in that scene and how that makes it perhaps even more of a concern.
Well, for one thing, the city is very heavily congested with traffic, and it makes getting around very, very difficult. They've been installing a lot of dedicated bus lanes for the games where the athletes will be able to move at fairly high speed, and so will officials, and so will some, but not all, of the spectators. There's an American company called Science Applications International Corporation, which is installing a network of about 1,500, maybe 1,600 CCTV cameras around town to monitor key intersections to make sure there's no difficulties with traffic flows and to provide command and control arrangements if there are any incidents. But there's also been some backlash from locals here. There is a group of civil libertarians that have been staging demonstrations against all the security precautions. And one of the local mayors got so incensed. This is the mayor of Nicaea, where they've got the weightlifting center. He sent out crews to paint over the CCTV cameras' lenses black. I don't think the full implications of the security issues have fully set in yet. And I think we've just finished elections here, and everybody's been preoccupied with the new government and what's going on. And Easter is coming up, so everybody's thinking about the holiday. But I think this question could become a really live question, say, come May.
Well, Bob, thank you.
Welcome.
Bob McDonald reports to the Economist Intelligence Unit. He spoke to us from Athens.
Just ahead, a bill moves through Congress to put commercial space travel under FAA jurisdiction.
And later, Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts says bigger government is the way to go to create jobs.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
You can escape Earth's gravity, but not the long reach of its laws. That's because the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill this month that, for the first time, puts spaceflight under the jurisdiction of the Federal Aviation Administration. The Commercial Space Launch Act is intended to encourage spaceflight by private companies, including manned missions. But why would a company go to all the trouble to send someone into space? Well, for a $10 million prize, for one thing. Peter Diamandis is the chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation, and he's here to explain. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, good to be here.
Tell me about the XPRIZE Foundation.
Well, we have put together a $10 million cash prize, which is being given to the first privately funded team that can build a spaceship that can carry three adults up into space, back down, and then, importantly, do it again within 2 weeks, so it's a reusable ship. And we're hoping this will bring about a new generation of private space travel so the rest of us can go and do what very few lucky men and women have done around the world.
Now, if you need to offer a cash prize, Peter, as an incentive, it sounds like it's not an obvious way to make money.
Well, the markets for public space travel have been estimated to be in the $1 to $3 billion a year market. In other words, people who would spend upwards of $100,000 to go and make their childhood or adult dreams come true. I mean, I'd like to go. I'm not sure about yourself, but at least 15,000 people a year have said they'd have an interest in going into space.
What kind of spacecraft would carry someone like me or you into space? What would it look like?
Well, we now have 27 teams from 7 countries competing for the competition. And each of these ships is markedly different. In fact, they're different from anything you've seen on television with that NASA or the Russian Space Agency has put out. We have some of the XPRIZE spaceships that take off like an airplane using jet engines, get up to about 50,000 feet, and then ignite rocket engines to go up. We have 2 teams, one in Israel, one in Canada, that uses a balloon to actually go to 80,000 feet, the upper reach of the atmosphere, before they ignite the rocket engines. Another team tows their rocket behind a 747. Another one is launched out of the water. Basically, we have sort of a Darwinian evolution. We put up the prize and didn't tell people how to solve it, just said, hey, build a ship that can do this safely twice in 2 weeks. And we have every one of these technical niches being explored. So we'll find out what is the best solution.
Anyone close to pulling any of this off?
Yeah, we launched the prize in St. Louis in May of 96, and now 8 years later, we actually expect a winner of the X Prize in this coming summer of 2004.
And the idea would not be science, but people go into space, look back at the Earth. It's really about tourism.
It is. We've modeled the XPRIZE actually after the early days of aviation prizes. Not many folks know that Charles Lindbergh didn't just wake up one day and decide to cross the Atlantic. He was pursuing a $25,000 prize offered up by a Frenchman, Raymond Orteig, living in New York. And 9 teams went after that $25,000. Lindbergh, the youngest and the underdog, made his trip 33 and a half hours later. From New York to Paris, won the $25,000 and really kicked off a golden age of aviation. And we're hoping to do that with the XPRIZE as well.
Now, as we mentioned, Peter, the Commercial Space Launch Act was passed earlier this month by the House of Representatives. It goes to the Senate. Tell me about it and what impact it has on your plans.
Sure. We are about to bring about a new generation of launch vehicles that can physically make the trip into space and back at a reasonable cost. The question is, can you go and buy a ticket on it? Mm-hmm. And when this was put forward to the government, there was the dilemma of how do we regulate this? How do we make sure that it's safe for the people flying, but also the people around it? And the Office of Commercial Space Transportation under the FAA was given the jurisdiction to regulate this. So what's going to happen is these ships will soon be available, and if they abide by the FAA's regulations, you as an individual will be able to go buy a ticket to go. Now, what's important is that this then has the potential to make space travel a profitable industry that will reinvest its profits, improve the quality and safety. The same reason that personal computers went from room-sized government-owned computers to, a laptop you can buy, and put on your child's desk, is because we had volume in a commercial market. So we hope to take space travel from where it is today with the space shuttle, very expensive, very few flights per year, government-owned and operated, and build an industry where there's not 4 or 5 flights of the shuttle per year, but thousands of flights of this new generation of suborbital ships initially, driven by the public markets.
Now, to encourage this private enterprise, I understand the Washington legislation has some insurance provisions.
Well, that's true. And, in fact, it's been part of the Commercial Space Launch Act of satellites since the Challenger accident in 1986, when the industry was encouraged to take over launching satellites from NASA, that the industry said, hey, we'll do this, but we can't take the risk of what if one of these rockets really does something terribly wrong and lands in the wrong place. So the government actually put a cap on the liability where it said, we're going to cap it at $500 billion, and anything above that, we're going to absorb the liability. Well, there's a similar cap where a private company would insure to a certain level, and the insurance industry would pick up the cost of any kind of an accident there. But above that level, the government would actually pick up the tab.
Now, this X Prize, this $10 million prize, does expire at the end of the year, right? Are you going to extend it?
Yeah, it does. We we had no idea when we put this forward when it would be won. We were thinking the 02 to 04 time frame, and we have a deadline of January 1, 2005. All the teams know this, and I feel fairly confident we're actually going to have a winner well within that window. If we don't, we may find ways to extend it, and we'll see. But I know that of the 27 teams, at least six or seven are actively building and testing their hardware, and at least two or three will be making attempts this coming summer.
Wow, exciting stuff. Peter Diamandis is the chairman and president of the XPRIZE Foundation. Peter, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, almost 1 year from the start of the war in Iraq, we speak to a reporter who was there then and is back now to see how things have changed.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Some say it's fast becoming the defining issue of the presidential campaign, job creation. You've heard it before. The U.S. economy's in a jobless recovery. The stock market and corporate profits are up, but job growth remains near stagnant. The Bush administration says jobs will follow the expanding economy, but it hasn't happened yet. New jobs in the past 3 months are way under White House predictions. Massachusetts Democratic Congressman Barney Frank has an interesting analysis of the jobs problem, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Congressman Frank.
Thank you.
Congressman, why haven't jobs been created as the economy's recovered?
Well, oddly, it's partly good news. A part of it is that we have increased productivity. Alan Greenspan was asked when he testified a couple months ago whether unemployment was going to go down. He said, well, only if productivity drops. Now, increasing productivity is one of the goals of civilization. I mean, in our work lives, to the extent that we can make more things, produce more goods, and supply more services with less effort, that means more leisure time, more recreation time, more cultural activities. The problem is that this has been done partly through the technology, but partly through public policies in a way that means that all of the benefits of the increased productivity, or almost all, are going to the owners of capital. And so what's happened is, for a variety of reasons, the people who own the capital, who run the financial enterprises, are able to get the increased productivity, not share any of it with the workforce, because what we're seeing is not simply prolonged unemployment when growth has begun to return, but real wages for those who were employed dropped last year. Plus, health benefits, which most people get through their workplace, are being either cut back or people having to pay more for them. So added to the productivity is globalization. You have now an ability by the people in charge to send work all over the world. And finally, and this is an important point, we've had a systematic erosion of the ability of working people to defend themselves, including a sustained and unfortunately successful assault on the labor unions in the private sector. So that's the resulting imbalance.
So you've got a private economy geared to creating wealth, not jobs. What do you do? How do you create the jobs?
Well, there are a couple of things you do. First of all, you reverse the public policies that have made the situation worse. I don't think public policy has created this. It's technology and globalization that's made possible by technology. But we have had tax policies under the Bush administration that make it worse, that remove all taxes from capital and increase taxes in a real sense in many ways, on working people. You stop undermining labor unions. But beyond that, there are a couple of things you do. First of all, one of the problems in hiring in America is when General Motors hires someone to work on producing cars, General Motors has to pay not just the wages and the Social Security, but the health benefits. Volkswagen doesn't have to do that. Toyota doesn't have to do that. This system in America whereby health benefits are tied to the job imposes a marginal cost increase on any employer who's trying to hire someone in these areas. We ought to get out of the business of providing health care largely through your job, put a universal health care system in so that every citizen, every resident gets health care. That would be helpful in terms of removing a disincentive to hire. Beyond that, though, I still think the private sector has gotten more efficient, and it's going to be able to produce more with fewer people. What we should do is to take a small part of that increased wealth, do some things publicly. This is a time, I believe, when we ought to share some of the increased wealth that the private sector is generating with the public sector, with states, with cities, for a couple of reasons. First of all, cities, states, they are labor intensive. They hire police officers, teachers. There are unmet public needs. There are, in my district, environmental Superfund sites that are being left uncleaned up. With the concerns about security, homeland security, there are more demands on police and firefighters, more teachers.
And you pay the salaries of these jobs essentially by levying a tax on corporate profits?
Yes. You reverse the trend, not just corporate profits, but individual incomes. You reverse the trend of reducing taxes entirely on the owners of capital. The Bush administration has lavished over a 10-year period hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars on the wealthiest people in the society, and I don't think that's necessary to do production. We're not talking now about a short-term tax break to stimulate the economy. That's over. We're talking about the tax cuts that are yet to go into effect years from now on estates, on dividends, et cetera. And yes, I would use some of that and put it into the public sector.
Huge deficits, historically huge deficits, and you're talking about raising taxes to create jobs instead of paying off the debt.
No, you would do both. I think you need to raise taxes, undo some of these tax cuts so that we can reduce the deficit. But in addition to reducing the deficit, there are important public purposes to be served in cleaning up the environment and providing transportation, providing public safety, and educating people. The point is that those now have the advantage not only of performing those services, but also of providing a source of employment that we seem to need.
Is this a politically viable idea? Could you get it through Congress?
Oh, you couldn't get it through this Congress because it is dominated by a very right-wing ideology. I also believe that there is a problem right now because, frankly, it's become too popular in recent years to bash government. People talk about government's terrible. And I included this, by the way, some of my friends on the Democratic side, John Edwards and Howard Dean both, who acted as if Washington was only one degree removed from hell. I've always felt that there were important values to be vindicated by adequately financing the public sector. What I'm saying now in the current economic situation is that you need that for the economy as well.
Two questions about presumptive Democratic nominee Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. What do you think he would think of your idea?
Well, I think he is in favor of some of it. But I think in the current political climate, when you say, as I have been saying, that there is an important role for government that we have minimized, the initial reaction of a lot of people is, gee, we don't like that. The public is a little bit divided here. What I find is that people don't like government in general. They just like almost everything that government does. Mm-hmm. And you probably have to connect the dots. So, look, I have a number of views that I think are very important that I don't think you could use as a presidential platform. If I thought that everything I thought was a basis on which you could be elected president, as dearly as I love John Kerry, I'd probably run myself.
Question two about Kerry. Speaking of running yourself, would you be interested in his Senate seat should he become president of the United States?
Yes, I would. It depends on a number of factors. Under current law, that election wouldn't happen until 2006. It does look as if in 2006 we may be dealing with a referendum on same-sex marriage. If that were the case, I couldn't run for the Senate because I would want to be involved in that referendum. I believe by 2006, people are going to see that same-sex marriage really is not a problem for anybody who isn't in one. Might be a problem for a couple of people who are, but that's the nature of human existence. And I will want to spend my efforts, to the extent that I'm not just doing my own congressional job, to help defeat an amendment that undoes the Supreme Court decision. But if the legislature changes the law and there's a special election next year, yes, I'd be very interested in running.
Congressman Frank, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Barney Frank is a congressman from Massachusetts.
Still to come, a new play based on the pre-trial depositions made by Cardinal Bernard Law in connection with the Boston clergy sex abuse scandal.
You're listening to Here and Now.
In recent months, we've heard a lot about jobs from the U.S. being sent overseas. But what's the perspective on the receiving end? For just one point of view, we turn to a 23-year-old worker in Bangalore, India. Now, we know you want to remain anonymous, that you work for a large American computer company taking phone calls from American customers with computer problems. How do you like your outsourcing job?
It's a very boring and monotonous job. There's nothing new in it. And no excitement at all.
Well, now, wait a minute. We hear that the salaries of people like yourself who do IT work, it's the highest average salary increase in the Asia-Pacific region, and your average is way above the average salary in Bangalore.
No, not really. Actually, it's less than, look, it may not be less than the average salary, but it could be the average salary.
Can you put a number on your salary? Can you tell us what you make?
About $250 a month.
Uh-huh. How is that relative to what an Indian would make in Bangalore on average?
As of now, if you check out the software industry, they make at least 3 to 4 times more than what we make.
In India?
In India, in Bangalore. That is what makes you a little angry.
Tell us a little bit more about the job. We understand that call centers in particular are presenting health problems for Indians because of the hours.
Exactly. Since we work during nights more, our whole schedule is totally upside down. Our biological clock has changed, so we miss out on our meals, and most of the times we end up having junk food.
I'm reading a story from Mumbai, India, about how because of, as you said, the time difference, call center workers have back pain, increased smoking and weight gain, extramarital affairs, and severe health problems.
I would accept most of them. Smoking, yes. As I see in my own office, I see that at least 90% of people smoke here. I hadn't seen that earlier.
Tell me this. Are you allowed to tell people who call you where you are? Do people ask you where are you?
Yes, people do ask us, and we are allowed to tell them where we are.
And what do they say to
you? That depends a little on what kind of a customer it is. If it's an irate customer saying, I don't want to speak to Indians, then we have to tell them that we're from somewhere else.
And do you often hear people say, I don't want to talk to Indians?
Yes. About 30 to 40% of the people do not want to speak to Indians. Mm.
These people that call you when they get angry at you, what would you want to say to them?
Well, I'd want them to know how tough it is for us, actually. It's not that we are happy about the whole thing. It's not that... I don't know how to put it. I mean, they keep insisting on having Americans speaking to them or somebody with a proper accent. Even if there's somebody who speaks good English, they'll just because it's an Indian, they'll keep saying, I don't want to speak to you. You speak rubbish. You don't know to speak English.
Yeah.
So I want them to know that it's not that way always.
What would you want them to know, too, about the very fact that you have the job? I mean, the accent is one thing, but if there's resentment of the job, what would you want to say to them?
I would want them to know exactly how it is here. I mean, how much they pay us and how the working conditions. It's not that we are very happy about the job. It's just that we're doing it because we need the money.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking to us.
No problem.
From Bangalore, India, an outsourcer for an American computer company who doesn't love his job but wants to keep it, so he shall remain nameless. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Victims of clergy sex abuse have been traveling to a theater in Chicago to hear the words of a man they accuse of turning a blind eye to the sins of priests. The dialogue in Sin, A Cardinal Deposed, is taken straight from testimony made by Cardinal Bernard Law during the sex scandal in the Boston Catholic Church. In this scene from the play, lawyers try to find out, what did Cardinal Law know?
I cannot speak with any specificity about the allegation against him.
Are you generally aware there were allegations of sexual misconduct made against Father Martin?
I cannot give you any specifics. I just don't know.
I'm not asking for any specifics. Maybe I'm misreading your answer, or I'm not doing the question properly. Are you generally aware that there was an allegation of sexual misconduct brought against Father John Martin?
Against a minor? I would just have to check that out.
Okay.
I know he was sent for treatment, but I can't recall the specifics.
Do you know Father Gale?
Yes.
Did you know that there are allegations of sexual attacks against minors by Father Gale?
All right.
In each one of these cases.
Bernard Law eventually stepped down as Archbishop of the Diocese of Boston without ever admitting any guilt in the abuse scandal. Actor Jim Shepherd portrays Law in the Bailiwick Repertory Company production of Sin. Mark Steele plays Boston attorney Roderick McLeish. We spoke with both of them from WBEZ in Chicago. We also called playwright Michael Murphy in California and started our conversation with the three men by asking Jim Sherman how his portrayal of the Cardinal was received that first night on stage.
Afterward, in the lobby, opening night, when I had gotten out of my clerical garb and gone out for little wine and cheese, a survivor just came up to me and very emotional and said, "You bastard, you." And then just one other quick thing. Last week or so ago, one of the people from Boston was there, and afterward, during the talk back, she said to me, "I knew this was going to affect me because as soon as I saw you and the lights came up and you were in your robes and in a prayerful position, all I wanted to do was run up on stage and slap you."
Hmm. Mark, a quick thought from you as an actor on the stage. Can you feel that they are there, the survivors in the audience?
We, as the cast, can definitely feel it. This whole thing is kind of gone beyond doing a theatrical presentation and just kind of elevated to something different, where we kind of feel that we have a responsibility in voicing and sharing their stories.
Well, Michael Murphy, as the playwright, tell us a little bit how it started. We know the show is very simply staged, a two-hour drama. What convinced you to write this play in the first place?
Well, I came across the deposition transcripts, which were on the Internet. They were released by the court, which was very unusual. I printed them all out, about 1,000 pages, and took them with me on vacation, and I couldn't put them down.
Well, Michael, as you well know, sometimes art that aspires to be responsible and earnest and noble can also be dull. Obviously, this isn't. It's really impacting people. But why do you think that is?
Well, usually it's out of consideration for some position, meaning that there's an over-earnestness to be true to the deposition itself or be true to the trial itself. And this isn't a trial. This isn't a deposition. This is a play. And so where I come in as a playwright is to take that deposition and present it in a way that is dramatic for the stage while maintaining the authenticity of what happened there. And I think it's difficult because legal dialogue is very turgid, very repetitive, very strategic. I could feel, as I was going through the transcript, the attorney setting up a question that he's going to ask in 10 minutes later.
Yeah.
And sorting that all through, I went to lawyers, I interviewed people who were deposed, and I learned a lot about that to try to get out of that trap.
Jim Sherman, you play Cardinal Bernard Law, as we said, with so many damning words in these depositions. How do you play a character like that? Because, you know, we understand from talking to actors that a character can't be all one shade.
That's right, and that's the difficulty with a character like this. You've got to find other dimensions, and that has become one of the most difficult things to do. And the best you can do is take that and work toward finding whatever it is that he was thinking about, and that is that he's being pastoral to his priests, but not necessarily pastoral to the people. And so if there's any redeeming quality in it, I guess that would be it.
Well, let's listen to a scene from the play Sin, A Cardinal Deposed that might illustrate that point.
Is raping a child an unpardonable sin if you are a priest?
Objection. The First Amendment.
Before God, is it possible for someone to receive absolution from such a sin?
Yes, but that doesn't mean that one is then free, since they have received sacramental absolution, to function.
Is raping a child in any specific category of sin?
That's a mortal sin.
But it's not an unpardonable sin.
No, as I said, an unpardonable sin is a very specific term in Scripture with a very specific reference. Jesus came to save us from our sins.
Right.
He died on the cross, so he took upon himself the burden of our sins, so that anyone, no matter what their sin, if they are sorry for that sin, if they confess that sin, and if they attempt to alter their lives, then they may receive his pardon. And that is the meaning of his death on the cross.
Thank you.
Michael, just to reconfirm, all of the words that are in the play Sin were words that were spoken in the deposition. Did you write any fiction?
No, there is no fictional dialogue. In the deposition, there would be references to letters and memos. And even though the transcript of those letters and memos were not in the deposition, I included them in the play because they were available. Mm. Then there were some public statements made by different people, and I used those as well. So it's all the real words of the people. It's not, I didn't create the dialogue. Yeah.
Mark, as an actor, knowing that you're speaking words that were actually spoken by people, how does that impact you?
This is the first time that I've done work like that. And it really kind of, it's affected all of us, not only in the sense that these were real words and real people, but then as we started to meet people and we met with survivors here in Chicago, it really started to come home for all of us that we had a sense of responsibility to try to do their stories justice. Mm.
Michael Murphy, the playwright, or Jim Sherman, the fellow who plays Colonel Bernard Law, have either of you heard from him?
No, this is Jim, and I haven't. And I doubt I will.
Michael?
No. The Archdiocese of Boston, the Archdiocese of Chicago have pretty much taken a no-comment stand on everything.
Mark Steele, how tough is it to immerse yourself in this topic, especially when you know that it's all very real?
There's definitely been a lot of sleeplessness in preparing for this. Every day still, we meet people who tell us a new story of something that happened to them or people that they know, or we'll hear another story about, you know, something that Cardinal Law is known to have done or other priests and things like that. And we're now living this every single day, and it has changed aspects of my life. I have two children, and, like, I want to be more involved in their lives. I want to make sure that they know how much I love them every single day. So it really has had a lasting effect on parts of my life that I never would have expected.
Michael Murphy, one last question. Are you surprised at how people have responded traveling, you know, across the country, we hear, to come see the play?
To say it's beyond my wildest dreams doesn't even describe it. I mostly did it for myself because I was really so horrified with what I was reading in Boston, and I was really motivated by that. This has to stop. We've got to start taking responsibility to what's happening to kids in this country.
I want to thank all three of you for talking to us about the play Sin, Cardinal Deposed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Sherman plays Cardinal Bernard Law. Mark Steele plays Attorney Roderick McLeish in Sin, A Cardinal Deposed, currently in production at the Bailiwick Repertory Company in Chicago. Playwright Michael Murphy also joined us by phone from California.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild's our engineer. He's assisted by Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.